I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
Ms. Obrador claimed there was widespread fraud discrediting the voting process. Evidence submitted to them wasn't convincing.
Reports. Murray Energy Corporation is alleging damages from a blog post that categorized the company's activities as criminal.
Murray Energy and its owner, Bob Murray, operate mines throughout Appalachia, Illinois, and Utah. A company subsidiary pleaded guilty to criminal mine safety violations for the accident that killed six miners and three rescue workers at Utah's Crandall Canyon mine in 2007. Another subsidiary recently pleaded guilty to criminal violations of the Clean Water Act. In the complaint, which was recently transferred to federal district court, the company claims a blog post written by Charleston Gazette reporter Ken Ward was libelous and damaged business and Bob Murray's reputation. Murray Energy is seeking more than $150,000 in damages. Attorneys for the Charleston Gazette didn't return request for comment.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. How do we make our moral judgments, those gut feelings about what's right and what's wrong? While we like to think that our ideologies are based on reason and facts, our guest today says, no, not even close. We're talking this hour with social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, whose new book, The Righteous Mind, examines this question of moral decision-making. And the analogy he uses is an elephant with a rider. The elephant represents our intuition, or what we call our gut. It's huge, and Haidt says it's the one really in charge, despite the tiny human on top. That person, Haidt says, is a mere mouthpiece, a spokesman for the elephant, skilled at making up seemingly rational explanations for whatever the elephant has done. Despite what the rider says, though, Haidt argues it's the elephant who guides our moral judgments from how we practice our religion to how we vote. Haidt says it's essential to realize this if we're ever to understand the deep kinds of philosophical divides which plague our national discourse. Today in The Exchange, how and why we make moral judgments with social psychologist and author Jonathan Haidt. Again, his new book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Let's hear from you, too. How rational do you think your moral decisions are? Are they based on the facts, or your gut, or a little bit of both? Have you ever had a shift in your moral thinking? What made you change? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Jonathan Haidt is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. He joined us from there. And John, great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, getting to that elephant, and that's a great analogy. Where does the elephant come from, all those immediate, big moral judgments or intuitions or gut feelings? Where do they come from?
Well, the thing people have to realize is that our ability to judge anything is a very ancient ability. Animals make all kinds of judgments. Our brains are really good at making judgments. And then very recently in our history, we got this ability to use language, but it's not as though our brains got suddenly totally rewired to put language in charge. So we're really good at making snap judgments. If any listeners have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, they know all that research. And then we're also really good at justifying things, but we justify things not to find the truth, but to persuade other people to join us.
So is it all just animal instincts? Are we all just relying on the reptilian brain there, or what?
Things begin with what you might call animal instincts, except that we are one hell of an animal. I mean, we are a lot smarter, a lot more sophisticated. We have very fine-tuned aesthetic judgments. We're always making judgments. So it begins with that. But then you have to see there's a kind of a feedback loop where our moral and political judgments, it's not as though we figured them out for ourselves when we were infants. There's a feedback loop with our experiences, the groups we join, the sermons we hear, our self-interest. So it's a complicated story, but a lot of people think that it is reasoned out. I would simply ask them, I would ask listeners, don't try to answer Laura's question about yourself. Try to answer Laura's question about how rational you are. Try to answer it about other people. Do you feel that when you argue with other people, they are basically going with the evidence that you present them, or do you feel as though they're going with their gut feelings?
Yeah, so the other guy is always going with his gut feeling, even though you are basing your argument on the facts.
Well, that's right, because your listeners are listening to NPR, and of course they are much more thoughtful, but everybody else is just the elephant.
Well, so let's go into the layers then about where, again, this elephant comes from that you say is really guiding us. All right, so we've got some animal instinct there. What about culture, parenting, even DNA? You know, you hear about, kids growing up in a family, and there's one kid who turns out to be the Democrat in the Republican family and so forth. So give us some of the layers that help create this elephant
sure.
that we all ride.
Sure. So, you know, the gigantic, huge, amazing finding in psychology in the 80s was that just about every trait is heritable. So if you have identical twins separated at birth, they tend to be similar in how religious they are, whether they're liberal or conservative, all that stuff. But then the other amazing finding is that if they're fraternal twins, they're as different as if they were next-door neighbors. Because if you share 50% of your genes with someone, as with your sibling, then you're totally different, because it's not an additive thing where the more genes you share, the more you're alike. The genes make your brain, and the total pattern of genes is what does it. So we all inherit a personality, and then as we grow through life, our personality guides us to certain kinds of groups and people. It makes our teachers treat us differently. So it's very, very common that siblings growing up in the same family end up very different, and that is not inconsistent with the genetic basis of our personalities.
And there's that feedback loop. So you've got this inherent personality, and then the way people react to you kind of strengthens that inherent personality, doesn't it? Is that what you're trying to say there, John?
Exactly. That's right. So it's not as though whether you're liberal or conservative is coded into your genes. It absolutely is not. What is coded into your genes is the tendency to make a brain that is, let's say, really open to new experiences and novelty and change and variety, and you like to try new restaurants that have some weird combination of world cuisines. If that's your brain, it doesn't mean you're going to be a liberal automatically, but you're going to tend to expose yourself to people and experiences that are going to have that feedback and make you more liberal, make you really like diversity, and make you really concerned about homogeneity or other sorts of things. So your personality, there is, again, that feedback loop. Your personality begins with innateness, but it's a complex developmental course, and that's what I try to trace out in Chapter 12 of the book.
Well, and I definitely want to get into that in a couple minutes, but I'm fascinated by what you present right up front in the book. Again, this idea that we think we're so smart and we're making our moral choices based on the facts, but in fact, it's all intuition. And you say again and again, John, intuition first, strategic reasoning second. How come?
Because our intuitions are instant. They happen within a second. There's so much amazing new research showing that we size people up. This is especially important for politics. We size up politicians when we first see them or hear them. Within a second, we're leaning towards them or away from them. And that then colors our reasoning. We then look for evidence to like them or evidence to dismiss them. So first impressions matter quite a lot. And once we're tilted, and often, you know, we're partisans, we know what party they are. You hear someone talk, you're never even going to really give them a chance, often, because you're just looking for reasons to either dismiss them or to back them up. And so that's what the rider really is. The rider is our conscious verbal reasoning. We're all very good at it.
Is the rider on top of the elephant, yeah.
The rider on top of the elephant, that's right. And his job is not to be the boss or king or driver of the elephant wisely steering through the woods. Rather, he's really up there more as a servant. I could have chosen the metaphor of a horse and rider. That's what Plato used, and that's what Freud used to express the divisions of the mind. But horses are not all that smart compared to people. I wanted an animal that was much, much larger and much, much smarter. Elephants are very smart creatures, and so is our unconscious.
So you say we size people up in a second based on the intuition, and then we kick into the strategic reasoning mode, basically looking for facts and figures that will justify that intuition.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
You know, it's interesting. I often will watch political debates with my two boys, and because they don't know the facts or really care about somebody's tax policy or whatever, mm-hmm. they immediately key in on what everybody knows but nobody else wants to say, because everybody else wants to say, well, I support him because of his taxes, or I support him mm-hmm. because, you know, of his health care policy. But they key in on that intuitive, you know, I like that guy, I don't like that guy.
Yep. Well, there you go. Out of the mouth of babes. That's right.
Does this mean then, John, that everything is a matter of intuition? There's no absolute truth, my moral judgments are based on nothing but my gut, that there's no, you know, right or wrong? I know that's kind of a philosophical question, but...
Yeah, it's two totally separate issues. So when we make aesthetic judgments, I think that's the best model here. We make aesthetic judgments. Now, does that mean that something, there's no such thing as something being more beautiful? We size up people of our preferred sexual orientation. Does that mean there are no differences between people, no real differences? It's all just a matter of taste? No. Moral truth, I think, is like the truths of beauty. There is no reason to, if intelligent aliens come here from another planet, there's no reason to think that they're going to agree with us about the beauty of Angelina Jolie or about, our views about individual rights or tax policy. These things are features of who we are as a species. We have a unique evolutionary history that makes us size up beauty, sexual beauty, the beauty of landscapes, the beauty of fairness, the beauty of loyalty. All of these things, I believe, emerge from our evolutionary past. That doesn't mean that they're just illusions. It means that they are what philosophers call anthropocentric truths. They are true, but they are true for creatures like us.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join us, and then lots more to dig into. Our phone number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And today in The Exchange, we're talking with professor and social psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his new book, The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. In it, he explores how we reach different moral judgments about the same issues. Later on, he goes on to talk about how we join groups to reinforce these judgments. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. How do you think you reach your moral judgments, whether they have to do with politics or religion or other fundamental matters? Do you think they're based on reason and logic and facts, or on your intuition, your gut feeling? And then to pick up on Jonathan's question, how do you think others make their decisions? Do you see them as less rational than you? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And just to wrap up this piece of it, Jonathan, you write that we humans are programmed to be hypocrites. Now, that's a pretty strong statement. What are you trying to say there?
What I'm trying to say is that we are shaped and tuned and evolved to succeed in the very complex game of social life. So it's like we carry around a press secretary with us. So one part of our brain is doing the judging. Another part of our brain, or at least another system in our brain, is doing the justifying. And since they're not the same, it's very much like if you look at the president's press conferences, and his press secretary is out there justifying stuff. Well, the press secretary only has a very loose connection to what President Obama is actually thinking. They're separate processes. So we're designed to do PR, and this PR is not related to the reasons we actually reached a policy.
So we do the PR, in other words, the little teeny rider on top of the big elephant, to fit in, to make others like us?
Yes. Well, it's to justify what we've already done. So we're very good at covering our tracks, and we do it so well that we usually believe we're honest. I mean, you look at these guys who get convicted of all kinds of, horrible scandals and fraud and hypocrisy. And in most cases, they seem to sincerely believe that they were innocent.
Wow.
We're very good at this, and we fool even ourselves.
We will talk more after a short break. And start taking your calls, too. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mike Danielli. Classical New Hampshire is a classical music service in the Granite State, a partnership between NHPR and Highland Community Broadcasting. Classical New Hampshire brings the best classical music performances from around the world to New Hampshire. Online everywhere at classicalnh.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Woodstock, Vermont Area Chamber of Commerce, hosting the third annual art festival and wine tasting on September the 8th and 9th on the Green. Information at woodstockvt.com. And from the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction, partnering with more than 240 local and regional food producers and farmers to bring customers the foods they seek. More of The Exchange on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, author and professor Jonathan Haidt explains how and why we evolve to make the moral judgments we do and how we justify those judgments. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. If you've ever changed your gut feeling or moral judgments, what led to that change and how hard was it? Also, what do you think about Jonathan Haidt's statement that we are programmed to be hypocrites? We make these decisions based on our gut feeling, and then we spend a lot of time justifying them with reason and logic that we find to back up those decisions. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page and call 1-800-892-6477. And Jonathan, let's go first to Louisa waiting in Lebanon. Hi, Louisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a believer in debate and in what's called critical thinking, as long as it's unsparingly applied to the self as well as to whoever is on the other side of a subject. I think that's the only way that what's called the public interest can genuinely be evaluated. It sounds, from what I've heard so far, as though there's absolutely no room for that, for valuing that process and that effort to self-criticize in your guest theory. There's no room for it unless there's more to be discussed.
So, Louise, are you saying, hey, is there any room at all for, you know, facts, reason, and
well,
so forth?
Well, not just facts, but self-evaluation. It's been shown, I mean, the science of management is extraordinarily helpful with this. It's been shown that in organizations, people will interpret their jobs more and more in their own interest to the detriment of the mission of the organization unless management is able to remind people of what they're truly supposed to be doing. There are wonderful examples of this in any amount of management books. And consciousness is at work there, and consciousness is engaged in denying the animal self what it immediately wants and doesn't really want to examine. In other words, I'm suggesting that self-examination and the public interest have some value, some reality, and are to some degree attainable.
Louisa,
and people who would push that aside are putting us in trouble.
Two terrific points, Louisa. Thank you so much for joining us. Go ahead, Jonathan.
So, Louisa, that is a great question because, I'm not saying let's just stop reasoning. Reasoning is crucial for this reason, that we are each so good at confirming what we want to believe. The only way around it is to get someone else to disconfirm it for us. So my argument is that we each as individuals are quite flawed. We're not very good at finding the truth, especially when partisan interests come into play. But if you put people together in the right way so that other people can challenge our confirmation bias and disconfirm, then you can get very good rationality. And that's what science is. Science is not something that works because scientists are so smart. Science works because it's an institution in which each of us is actually trying to confirm our pet theories or our prior research, but then we have to go through peer review and others are disconfirming it. And if it's set up right, then the truth comes out. So the only thing I would add to your praise of critical thinking and debate is when you bring people together who don't know each other, and especially if it's anonymous, as on the web, you tend to get absolute zero persuasion. Nobody changes their mind. So when people engage just at the level of arguments and you say something and I criticize your arguments, that tends to be kind of a waste of time. But when people know each other, especially if they meet socially, suppose they're eating together, there are all sorts of things that build relationships. And when you have relationships, then you actually can be open to what somebody else is saying. A huge problem in our country is that those relationships in Congress are now gone. Until the 1990s, congressmen lived in Washington. They knew each other. They knew each other's spouses. Their kids went to the same schools. They were able to talk to each other. That all ended in the 1990s. Hardly any of them live in Washington anymore. They don't meet people on the other side. And therefore, all they have is debate, critical debate. They throw reasons at each other, and it doesn't do anything.
And the reasons don't stick. You know, it's interesting. Here in New Hampshire, people say that before the interstate was in great shape, was still being built, all the lawmakers from both sides who lived from far out of town would gather at the Highway Hotel, it was called, and they would sit around the piano and sing and drink. And I have heard the old-timers say that they were able to reach decisions on bills important to the legislature because they
exactly
had those personal relationships.
That's right. So those personal relationships are crucial. I just got back from a trip in London, where it sounds like they don't have anywhere near the gridlock and terribleness of our government. And it's in part because they all live in London. They all are linked, you know, in many cases through, you know, literally through family connections going back many years. But their political class is healthier for that reason.
You know, it's interesting, too. She talked about doesn't debate and reasoning have any role in decision-making and changing people's minds. And you said, yes, you say, Jonathan, if you want to change somebody's minds, though, you got to talk to the elephant.
Exactly. So if you just have riders coming together, imagine you have a debate between Obama's press secretary and John Boehner's press secretary. Let's put them both up on the stage and have a debate. How much progress do you think we're going to make? Not a lot. But if you get the elephant, if you can speak to the elephants, if you can get them off of a defensive posture and make them actually curious. I mean, this is what I love about politics, is that we're talking about ideas that are the most important ideas for our survival as a nation. And I find there are really good ideas on both sides. And once you, if you study moral psychology and you see how each of us, morality blinds us to half of the idea space, I'm hoping that reading my book and studying moral psychology can reduce the demonizing and open people up to all these interesting ideas and arguments that are really out there.
Well, and one more follow-up to Louisa's great call. And again, thanks, Louisa. She talked about moral psychology, the use of reason and so forth in the business sector, and that management has a role in getting people away from their own selfish pursuits and committed toward the broader goal. You write about that in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, because business is a fascinating fascinating place to study moral psychology. I'm actually at a business school now. I'm actually spending this year at NYU at the Stern School of Business. And businesses are so interesting because the whole business world is basically institutions or firms, let's say, in which people are competing within the firm for promotions and advancement and profits, bonuses, let's say. But they're also cooperating with each other to compete against other firms. And to the extent that business is often a lot of fun, I mean, many people love going to work, it tends to be those businesses that can suppress self-interest to a large degree and get people to feel that they're part of a team, part of something larger. And my argument in the book is that we evolved for that, we're designed for that, and we find many of our greatest joys. So it makes sense that management has a role to play in preventing the kind of the creep of selfishness and reminding people that they're part of a team and let's all work together.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talked earlier about the elephant analogy. Again, that elephant being our moral intuition that really guides our decision-making. And you do have another set of animal analogies, John. You say we're 90% chimp and 10% bee. And that's what we're talking about right now in that business setting. Give us a little more on
exactly.
That.
Exactly. So there's so many books written on evolutionary psychology and on the evolution of morality, and they pretty much all say, you know, going back to Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, well, you know, animals are always selfish except if it's kin selection, so we're nice to our relatives, or if it's reciprocal altruism, we're nice to those who might help us out in the future. And this gives you kind of a cynical view of human nature, and that's fine, that's all true, that's all justified. That's what I'm calling our 90% chimp side. Listeners who've read any work by Franz Duval knows that chimpanzees can do some somewhat pro-social things. So you can get a lot of our moral nature by assuming that we're just like chimpanzees. But then there's all this weird stuff we do about joining religions, sacrificing ourselves for teams, losing ourselves in the pursuit of noble ideals. Now, chimps don't do anything like this. And my argument is that it's because we humans are products of group-level selection in relatively recent times, in the last half million years. We were shaped by a little bit of group versus group competition, which gives us these new abilities to join groups, love our groups, and fight for our groups. And so what I'm trying to say in the book is, in part one, let's study moral psychology. Let's understand all this stuff. And once we understand all this groupishness, then we can look at politics and religion. And suddenly they make a lot more sense if you understand our tribal or more bee-like, hive-like nature.
Bees being everybody groups together and works like crazy for the common goal.
Well, the common goal being of the hive, not of all
right.
Bees, just of your hive.
Right. Let's take another call if we could. Louisa, thanks a lot for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And waiting in Stratum is Bob. Hi, Bob. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Yes. I've heard the term intuition being used two or three times at the early part of the program, and I've bumped around with self-help books and hearing people make statements on various media or whatever. It seems there is some kind of a difference. How much of a difference, to what extent is there a difference between what people call intuition and what is habit response?
What do you mean by habit response there, Bob?
Well, it seems that what's being described as part of the program was our collection of habits which people use, and it makes perfect sense if you're driving an automobile, if you're ice skating, or shoveling snow, whatever it might happen to
be. Sure.
That there are habits that you develop to carry things out, reading books, studying for courses and all of that, and whether you're a CPA or whatever. And that's all largely habit, although there may be certain points where you have to use discretion for judgment, and then also perhaps is that where intuition enters it? What about improvisational musicians? How much of what they're doing is intuition?
Wow.
And other artists as well.
Great questions, Bob. Thank you so much. What do you think, Jonathan? A couple things to pick up on there.
Yeah, no, that's a great psychological question. So the way to start thinking about this, I think, is that neurons have this interesting property, which is that neurons that fire together wire together. So as we learn something, as we have experiences, neurons in our brain that end up getting recruited together in the same task, then the next time that comes around, they'll fire together more easily. And this is why almost any complicated activity, when you're first explained it, it might even not be all that complicated, but you're slow to do it at first. And then with practice, it's a very straight learning curve. You get better and better. So I think that's what Bob is referring to about habit and behavioral habits. So behavioral habits, these are the sorts of things that the behaviorists studied, like B.F. Skinner. And once you understand that neurons do this, that our animal minds learn gradually in the way that Bob was talking about, now let's move to higher cognition, to thinking about more complicated issues or to doing improvisational music. And what do we find there? And it's the same thing. As we process information, as we think about political issues, let's say, we fall into certain habits, thinking habits. We tend, if you're on the left, you tend to see things in terms of who's being hurt, who's being oppressed, who's the victim. If you're on the right, if you're a social conservative, that is, you will more habitually see things in terms of, is this leading to disorder or to is this destroying social capital? Is it disrespectful? Is it an act of betrayal? So there are certain perceptual habits, and by the time you're an adult with a partisan identity, you just tend to see the world in terms of one or two filters versus other filters. So I think Bob's question is very helpful here. If you have any understanding of our behavioral habits, now apply that to our habits of thinking and reasoning, and we see that much of what we do, and this is what I mean by the elephant, much of what we do, even our higher thinking, is automatic. It's intuitive.
And it's very difficult to change those habits.
That's right. You can change them, and you've been asking your listeners to call in about times they've changed.
Right.
So you can change them, but you can't just decide to change it and voila, it's changed. As anybody who's tried to make New Year's resolutions knows, you can't just resolve to change yourself and then have it happen. That's the point of the rider and elephant analogy.
So how do you do it?
There's a couple of ways. First of all, people tend not to change themselves morally by will. People don't generally say, I want to be more liberal or more conservative. Rather, people tend to change because either they enter new groups, they're exposed to new ideas in that way, or sometimes they'll have a major life experience. You find out your child is gay or a good friend is gay, and suddenly you're able to see things from that person's perspective where before you might not have. So we do definitely, our lives are stories. They have turning points. They have drama to them. And we do sometimes make dramatic turns, but it tends not to just be by sheer force of willpower.
Mm, or a major health crisis, or
exactly.
Some men say they fought in a war and that was a life-changing experience. So
that's right.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Bob, thanks for that call. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is professor and social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. Again, his new book, brand new book, is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It looks at how we reach our moral judgments and how we justify those moral judgments. What do you think? How do you make these judgments yourself? Do you find them based on logic and facts, or do you agree that they're based largely on your intuition, your gut feeling? How do you think others make those moral decisions? How do you judge their moral judgments? And as Jonathan just alluded to, if you've ever changed your gut feeling, what led to that change? How hard was it? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And John, before we go back to our listeners, I want to get back to this idea of groupishness, that we have these groups that we select and we have new abilities to join groups. So we're not just operating on gut intuition here like most animals. And you write that men are especially groupish. How so?
So I believe, and I make the argument in the book, that we evolved in large part because of intergroup conflict. Once our ancestors became cultural and started doing tribal markings, we begin to find, even 100,000 years ago, we find signs in burial sites and archaeological sites that people were marking their bodies with colored, you know, with colored dyes and things like that. And so think ahead to the way gangs work. Gangs have these gang signs. They wear certain clothing. They use language in a certain way. And that's all to mark who's in and who's out. And this is crucial for why we now cover the earth, because we're able to cooperate with people who are not our kin. They're not our relatives. So many people on the left and in the academic world tend to think, well, groupishness is bad. Groupishness is evil. Groupishness is just one step away from racism.
We should all get along.
That's right. We should all get along on the whole planet. And while that's true that if there wasn't groupishness, there'd be no racism, that is certainly true. But if there was no groupishness, there'd be no groups. We would just be little groups of families wandering around the jungle still, where there'd be no civilization. So you have to see our groupishness as this miraculous ability to cooperate, to work together with people who are not kin, which has some unfortunate side effects, such as war and racism and genocide, yes. But we have to study this as part of our nature. We can't just dismiss it and wish we could somehow transcend it.
Right. Well, that's real interesting because, you know, you think about groupishness and it does come up in a negative context. I mean, you look at the Hutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda.
That's right.
To outsiders, you think, why on earth would these people have anything against each other? And yet, you know, it was a horrible genocide there. So
that's right. But if there was no groupishness, no ability to be a team player, there would be no businesses. There would only be families. Maybe you get families working together. But there would have been no capitalism, no industrial revolution. There'd be no material progress. There'd be no civilization.
Why are men especially groupish?
Ah, yes. That was the original question. So this is where I was going with that. So I think we are specialized for war, and the male brain is more specialized. So we all start off as girls in utero, and then around the 8th or 10th week, a little bit of testosterone flips a few switches, turns the girl brain into a boy brain. And some of the specializations you get then are that boys like to play in larger groups when they're kids, and they tend to divide up team versus team for sports, which is obviously practice for war. I mean, that's why we have sports. And if you just look at, this is not because adults tell us to play in different ways. It's in fact when boys and girls get to choose their own activities, that's when you see the biggest differences. So look at the way fraternities and sororities initiate. Male fraternities and colleges are straight out of anthropological accounts of initiation rites with scarification and, you know, pain and humiliation. They use to eat disgusting things, and they think they're going to die. I mean, it's terrifying. But this is what the male brain does to then reach really high levels of cohesiveness. This is why the military has hazing. Now look at sorority. Sororities have initiation too, but I had a graduate student, Sarah Aljo, who studied initiation rites at UVA. And what do? They have a big sister, little sister relationship. The big sister, let's say a junior in college, showers the little sister with presents and good experiences. And then after a week, she reveals who she is, and they hug and they kiss and welcome to the sorority. I mean, it's so nice.
I got to cut you off there, John, and we will be back after a very short break.
. 9:39, you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from the Cardigan Mountain School, a private boarding and day school for grades 6 through 9 in Canaan, New Hampshire, near Dartmouth, educating boys the Cardigan way, cardigan.org. And from Fuller Gardens, a public turn-of-the-century estate garden located on the ocean in Northampton, offering memberships that help our gardens to grow, online at fullergardens.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with professor and social psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his new book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It looks at how we make moral choices and how we justify those moral choices. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And John, let's go right back to our callers. This is Louis in Portsmouth. Hi, Louis. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for giving me time on the air.
Sure.
Yes, I was curious listening to the conversation. What's the role of conditioning? I mean, the speaker was talking about gut feeling, but I was thinking more in terms of conditioning as the explanation for why we react the way we do.
So parents and culture, Louis, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot for joining us. We should talk about that a little bit more, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So people hold their views and they say the things they say, very much shaped by what they expect to happen to them. And if you think that people are going to yell at you or hate you or snicker at you if you say something, you're much less likely to say it. So it is certainly true that in certain environments, people are afraid to say something or they're reinforced for saying it. So I'm in the academic world. And in the academic world, in the social sciences, almost everybody is on the left politically. And so it turns out that there are some conservatives, but they tend to be afraid to speak up in many fields because they will be called racist, basically, or associated with George Bush or some other very undesirable person. So there is certainly conditioning that changes our behavior, and that sometimes is separate from our internal beliefs. In terms of what gives us our deepest feelings, does conditioning give us our deepest feelings? I think sometimes it does bleed through, but conditioning is especially helpful for understanding overt behavior.
So the old nature versus nurture question, really.
Well, it's part of that feedback loop we were talking about.
Right.
Certain people's brains are going to make them just like liberal ideas or conservative ideas more, and then let's say they adopt them, they begin talking about them, and then people like them, they treat them as being smart. That will reinforce holding those beliefs to some extent, or not. So it depends on the environment you're raised in. The one thing I would add here is that research shows that people's personalities and values tend to come much more from their peers than from their parents.
Really?
So it's very much, think about why we have the accents that we do. Does anybody have the accent of their parents? No. If an immigrant comes here and they raise their kids here and they have a Spanish or a Czechoslovakian accent, whatever it is, no kid picks up that accent.
True.
We pick up our accent from the other kids around us. And it turns out to be somewhat true about our values. Parents do leave lasting influences in many ways, but it's been much, much less than anybody realized, whereas peers are even more than we realized.
You know, we've talked a lot, John, about different ways that we make moral judgments and somewhat about how liberals and conservatives view the world and make these moral judgments. What about libertarians, though? We've got lots of libertarians here in New Hampshire. You've looked at how they make moral choices, too.
Yes. So I have a website at www.yourmorals.org. And my colleagues and I there, we've collected data from about 250,000 people so far on a whole bunch of different surveys. And about 10 to 15% of the people who come are libertarians. So we actually have the world's best data set on libertarian personality, because we don't force people, when they register, we don't force them to say where they are on a 7-point scale of liberal to conservative. We allow them to pick the option libertarian. And then we can see what libertarians say compared to liberals and conservatives. And our basic finding, this is a bit of a surprise to us, but it makes sense once you think about it. Our basic finding is that libertarian personality is more like liberal than like conservatives. They're very open to experience. They're very analytical. They're tolerant of ambiguity. They're very deep thinkers. But they're much lower on feelings of compassion. They're lower on emotionality. They turn out to be the smartest, most rational group of all three. That is, they seem to be smarter and more rational than liberals or conservatives, but they're less compassionate than either one. And I think this allows them to be extremely consistent. They're actually the only consistent people out there. That is, they have one big value, which is liberty. And you look at Ron Paul, one big value, liberty. Well, if we instantiate liberty, if we give everybody liberty, some people are going to get hurt. What are you going to do then, Ron Paul? Answer, let them get hurt. Now, he had a much more nuanced answer than that in that famous Tea Party debate. But my point is that libertarians have one central moral value, just as they say, liberty. Whereas liberals and conservatives are always making these trade-offs, they're always being hypocritical, they're always pursuing one value in one place, another value in another place. So I think libertarians are fascinating. And if people go to, let's see, do I have it at my website, jonathanhaidt.com, I have links to my publications, so they'll find that paper there. I'll see if I can put up a link to it.
Well,
to
and we
make
often,
it easier.
We often put up links on our website.
Okay,
too,
I'll send you links to the paper.
And just let the audience know that Haidt is spelled H-A-I-D-T, not the way that you would think. So H-A-I-D-T. You know, getting into these value judgments that we make and which ones we adhere to and how we sort them out. And I love what you said, that libertarians are at least pure, and Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives are always being hypocrites because they'll apply one value one way in one instance and another value in another way in another instance. You've got a couple principles that you say guide our political and moral decision making, and you just picked out one, liberty. There's a couple more, though, that I'd like to ask you about and how they inform our decision making. One is care versus harm. Now, how do liberals and conservatives interpret these?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, you know, one of the most basic aspects of morality is not hurting people. Everybody knows that, and every culture recognizes that. And what we find, using a variety of measures, is that liberals seem to be a little, they seem to feel this more. If you think about these moral foundations as being like taste buds on the tongue, and you think of this as like the sweet receptor, the sugar receptor, compassion, care for people who are suffering, liberal cuisines or liberal moralities tend to hit that more. I don't have psychophysiological data on this, but my bet is that if you hook people up to galvanic skin response measures and you show them pictures of dogs getting kicked, liberals and conservatives are going to dislike it, but you'd get a slightly higher spike from liberals. I think that would be the case. And that leads to the charge that, liberals are bleeding heart liberals. They will endorse really bad policies or policies that produce all kinds of unintended side effects if they seem to help people who need help.
Fairness versus cheating. That's another big value.
That's right. Everybody thinks they favor fairness. Everybody's in favor of fairness. But it's so slippery. There's so many ways to apply it. And what we've found at yourmorals.org is that liberals tend to favor versions of fairness that are close to equality, especially quality of outcome. And if some people end up with a lot more than other people, that is obviously unfair. But the other big standard, which is really the more common standard worldwide, is equity, that is, or proportionality. Are people getting out rewards in proportion to what they're putting in? And here we find that conservatives are much more sensitive about this. They are perfectly happy to let some people end up with a lot less stuff if those people aren't putting in as much, aren't working as hard. And this is why welfare policies are always at the center of the culture war. And this is why, if you think about what launched the Tea Party, it was Rick Santelli's tirade. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's bathroom that took out a too big a mortgage and can't pay for it? It's all about, should we bail out people who made mistakes, or should we let them reap the consequences of what they've sown?
There's one more. You have six of these all together. And again, care is one, fairness is one, liberty is one. There's one more I want to ask you about. It's the idea of authority and how people's different elephants, again, those elephants that guide their moral judgments, how they approach this idea of authority.
That's right. I think this is really the most sensitive one in terms of differentiating the left and the right, is attitudes about authority. If you see a bumper sticker that says question authority, I mean, you know darn well that person is on the left side of the political spectrum. They could also be a libertarian, but you know that they're not on the right. So in liberal circles, the presumption is that authority is oppression. And even parental authority is often questioned. So liberals will endorse policies like guaranteeing that teenage girls can get abortions without having to get parental approval. Liberals are ambivalent at best about authorities. Conservatives tend to endorse authority much more strongly, I would say sometimes reflexively, sometimes uncritically. But I do think that conservatives are at least wise to the need for moral order. That is, if for example, in schools, liberals pushed in the 60s and 70s to allow students to sue their teachers and sue their school districts. And while that did enhance the realm of student rights, and there were some good things that came out of it, it ended up leading our schools, our public schools, into more chaos, and that ended up hurting everybody. So this was the big change for me. I started off very liberal when I began this work, but I've come to really see that both sides are wise to the needs of certain things that are necessary, And I think authority is one of them.
Our number here in the Exchange for you to join us. A couple more minutes to get your call in at 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your thoughts on how we make our moral judgments, our political judgments, what guides those judgments, and how we perceive others make their own moral decisions. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And John, one more thing. We've talked about political groups. What about religion? How does that fit in here with this idea of making moral judgments based on our feelings and not the facts?
So one of the big things that I think has been missed in moral psychology and in scientific thinking is the importance of sacredness. I'm not saying anything supernatural here. I'm just saying that when you get people together, they're very good at treating something as sacred and then circling around it. And this, I think, was the great trick that our ancestors developed in the last 200,000 or 300,000 years. They would make a rock sacred or a tree or an ancestor, and then they would circle around it, and in circling around it, they would come to trust each other.
Mm.
And so this is the prototype of religion. This is the way religion looks in hunter-gatherer groups and ancient groups. Modern religions look somewhat different, but they still literally often circle around sacred objects. I mean, look at the holy rite in Islam, in Mecca, circling around the Kaaba. Well, once you see that we just like to do this, then you can see that we all circle around sacred values. So on the left, there's a kind of a quasi-deification of Martin Luther King. On the right, they treat the flag as a sacred object and they'll circle around it. They want to amend the Constitution to ban flag burning. So we all come together to defend our sacred objects. I was on a talk show. I was on a bloggingheads.net, I think. Or at any rate, I made a comment, an offhand comment, like, people could probably just take a beer keg and make it sacred if they wanted to. Well, the next day I got an email from a guy who said, well, in fact, I belong to the Order of the Beer Keg or whatever it was called, but it's an English group started in the 30s or 40s in which they're runners, but then at the end they literally circle around a beer keg and then they drink. This is just what we do.
All right. Well, let's take one more call if we could. This is Shannon in Manchester. Hi, Shannon. You're on the air. Oh, and we missed out on Shannon. Sorry about that, Shannon. I hope you join us another time. I don't think we'll have time to take your call now. Just finishing up with this religious conversation, John, why do you say that religiously observant Americans are better neighbors and citizens?
Well, that's a direct quote from Robert Putnam. He has a book out called American Grace.
Yes, we know him. So, he lives in New Hampshire part-time, so we've had him on the
excellent.
Show a number of times.
All right. So he's the expert on social capital. And so it's a straightforward empirical question. Well, it's a difficult empirical question as to whether religion makes people more tribal so that they turn their backs on the rest of society, or whether it makes them, it brings out their better nature. And I think religion can go either way. I believe that our religiosity evolved to help us trust our groups and work together in our teams. But American religions, I think, and this is what Putnam finds, American religions tend to be very open. They tend to want to try to get recruits from other religions, so it's kind of a free market in which they're trying to attract converts. And they tend to enmesh people in moral worlds or moral matrices that are all about doing good and suppressing the self and not being selfish. And this seems to work. It doesn't matter so much whether you pray or whether you believe in God. The crucial thing is, are you a member of a congregation and you spend time with your religious congregation? People who do that turn out to give more to charity, and not just to their church. They then give more to other charities, non-church charities. They join organizations like the PTA. And so Putnam's conclusion, he's on the left and he's secular, but his conclusion is, you look at the data, well, American religions seem to bring out the best in people.
Right.
That's why I say it.
We did have Mr. Putnam on for that book. Now I do remember that, American Grace. Just real quick, though, what sort of a reaction do you get from your non-religious colleagues and friends on that observation?
There are some people who push back, the new atheist folks.
Yeah, I'm a good person. I give to charity. That thing.
Oh, yeah, I see. Well, no, certainly that's right. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that atheists are bad people. And, the people on the secular left are the ones who start charities, to focus on all kinds of neglected people all over the world and animals and animal rights. I mean, a lot of secular folk are also committed to making the world a better place. we're just saying, or at least what Putnam is saying, is just on average,
in
you
general,
find that religious. Yeah, that's all. But you know, look, why my book is subtitled "Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion," and people in all the groups are good in their ways, just often in different ways, and then they don't appreciate the way that the people on the other side are good in a different way.
Well, and let's hit on that. You know, again, you've got an ambitious goal for this book to understand why are we so divided into hostile groups, each one certain of its righteousness. Why do you think it's important to understand that? I mean, just because I understand where someone's coming from, John, doesn't mean I'm going to change my mind. So, you know, how does understanding really help anything?
So the most important thing that I'm hoping to do with the book is to just tone down the demonizing in America's moral and political life. Disagreement is generally can be very productive. Going back to the very first question that we had from Louisa, but disagreement can be productive if you don't think the other side is evil. You simply disagree on what's the best way to, you know, best kind of policy. But once we cross over, once things heat up to the point where we think the other side is evil, it's as though a switch flips, and our tribalism becomes really toxic. So think about the difference between intramural sports, where people at the same college will play each other on soccer teams, but they don't hate each other. But then you go to like English soccer hooliganism, where they literally want to break each other's knees, and that's the divide. That's what I want to change about our discourse in American politics. And so I'm hoping that if people understand the other side, they can at least say, "Oh, okay, now I at least get, at least I see why they favor that policy that I thought was insane before." So now we can really talk about, well, all right, you know, what are you after? What are we after? We're not after the same things, but at least now maybe I can respect what you're after.
Well, Jonathan, thanks a lot. This has been really interesting.
Oh, my pleasure, Laura. Thanks so much for giving me the chance to talk to your listeners.
That's Jonathan Haidt, again, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, author of the book we talked about, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. His earlier book is called The Happiness Hypothesis, and we'll put some of those links that he mentioned during the program on our website. That's nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer today is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Gohl. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a Labor Day special on women at work through the stories of three women, a pastor, a seasonal farm worker, and a judge. Then we talk with the retiring commissioner of the state's Department of Resources and Economic Development, George Bald, about his long tenure there. And we check in with New Hampshire Democrats on the scene of their national convention in North Carolina. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, each morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.